Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. We just heard the invention number one in C major by Johann Sebastian Bach, one of 15 two-part inventions that will be explored by our guest today, Simona Dinnerstein, pianist. Welcome back to Crossover, Simona. It's so nice to speak with you again.
Nice to talk with you.
Anybody who has studied piano, of course, studied some of the Bach inventions, at least. And your performance of them on this album is just beautiful, the clarity, the expression, and so on. But I wondered why you chose this as subject matter.
Well, I intend, over the course of the rest of my life, to record as many of the major keyboard works of Bach as I can. So I thought it'd be interesting to go back to the first counterpoint of his that I ever studied, which were the inventions. I've had a relationship with these pieces over the course of my life, first as a student, as a young person studying with them, and then teaching them as a young adult, and now playing them, now performing musician and going back to them and learning them that way. And I think that they're just completely undervalued. I mean, people tend to view them as just teaching tools, but actually they're incredible pieces of music. I mean, they're so beautiful to listen to and interesting and vibrant.
What was Bach's intention, do you think, when he wrote them? Was it for as a personal expression, or was it for teaching, or what?
He wrote a very beautiful preface to the edition where he wrote that it was a guide. He actually called it an honest guide to showing keyboard players, lovers of the keyboard, as he said, how to balance two or three voices at the keyboard, and how to do it in a cantabile style, meaning to make them sing. And, you know, he was such a great teacher. That was like a very important part of his job as a musician, was to teach. And I think that the greatest teachers teach us through art, not as an exercise, but through the art itself. And so though these pieces are, in a sense, a kind of musical essay on how to play counterpoint, they're expressed as complete works of music. You know, it's in the same way if you think about Chopin's etudes, his 24 etudes, which are on the one hand showing the pianist how to deal with the various technical challenges of playing the instrument, but it's done in the most artistic way so that they're actually beautiful, complete works that anybody would want to listen to.
Thank you. We just heard three of the two-part inventions, invention number two in C minor, number three in D major, and number four in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. Simone Dinnerstein, pianist. However, they're more complex. I don't say that the Bach inventions aren't, but they're very clear. I mean, the inventions are very bare in a sense. They need the input of the artist to express, I believe, what he is trying to say. But it's very exposed, if you know what I mean, in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a funny way, they're more difficult to play than
yes.
music that has a lot more notes.
Yes, obviously, you know? Obviously.
Yeah.
And the purity of it, of course, and the expression, you know, the linear expression. I mean, I think that it's an interesting subject, and I think for people that aren't really aware of your goal, which is, I think you have set a certain sights for yourself in your recordings, they probably are saying, I wonder why that at this time? And do you think that you would get that kind of a reaction? Or have you?
Well, I think, you know, people have definitely asked me why did I choose to record these pieces. And actually, I'm performing them, too. I'm performing the 15 two-part inventions in my recital programs and this season. It's a way of getting to the essentials. You know, I mean, I've been playing a lot of very complex music, and to pare it down the way mm-hmm. Bach did in
right.
these inventions, so that there's nothing extra. There's no flesh. You know, it's all
right. mm-hmm.
it's all the bones of the music, and to see how he made that speak and how profound it is. And to make that come across when you're playing, that's a real challenge. And
It's bare. I don't want to say it's bare because I think the melodic lines are very expressive. But it is. I mean, you can't hide behind anything. He's giving you a lesson, and he's also exploring your ability to speak through him. Melodically, in many cases, I think that's what you hear in that. It's again, mm-hmm. it's very exposed. I did read about a concert that you had given with the inventions and a monk tribute. I was curious about that. How did you? What did you do there?
Mm-hmm. This is a recital program I just did in New York.
Yes.
That has a piece by George Crumb.
Uh huh.
Which is a set of variations on Round Midnight, the Thelonious
yes,
Monk
tune. Yes, of course.
Tune.
Oh, my.
And the program was actually a program which explored counterpoint in various ways. I started with the 15 inventions, and then I played a piece that was written for me by Nico Muhly.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece is quite contrapuntal, and often three voices and sort of almost quasi-minimalist in some sections,
right,
but
right.
sort of based on early English, like pre-Bach music from the Fitzwilliam Notebook.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then I played George Crumb's piece, which is very contrapuntal, and he uses the extended piano. So in other words, I am not just playing on the keys, but I'm also plucking strings. I use a soft mallet on the cross bars of the piano.
Right.
I
prepared piano.
You know, do various mm-hmm. effects, and those create yet another layer, another texture, another musical line. And then I ended with Beethoven's Last Sonata, Opus 111, which is both a piece of music that looks back to Bach in that it's very contrapuntal style of writing, and you know, a set of variations on what sounds like a chorale, and yet also is dissonant and forward-thinking and kind of radical in so many ways. So I thought it was an interesting program that showed how far counterpoint can go.
Which, of course, is the basis of so very much. I mean, you know, when you play Bach, it's very exposed. But, of course, counterpoint is going on you know, in all music at some point, whether it be exposed or hidden. But for you to make these decisions, I would imagine that you do a lot of self-exploration, too. You know, you discover yourself in doing something so, again, pure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to get rid of anything that you might have been hiding behind when you play something like the Inventions. You know, there's no hiding in them. So, you know, over the years, it's like a spring cleaning. You know, you get rid of the yeah. excess that is not important, and try to get to the fundamentals in the music and in your own playing.
I love the way Johann Sebastian Bach had described what he was trying to do when he wrote these for his students. He said he wanted people to learn to play neatly, I love that word, in two parts, but also with further progress, and to play correctly and well in three obbligato parts. And at the same time, not only to obtain good musical themes, but also to develop them well. And so I guess that was part of the developing your taste for writing music and composition. But I love the word neatly, and you have to play very neatly when you play these marvelous works. Here now are two of them, the Sinfonia No. 1 in C major, that's BWV 787, and the Sinfonia No. 2 in C minor, BWV 788, performed by our guest today, Simone Dinnerstein. We just heard Sinfonia No. 1 in C major, BWV 787, and Sinfonia No. 2 in C minor, BWV 788, by Johann Sebastian Bach, from the newest album that is performed by our guest today, Simone Dinnerstein, Bach, Inventions and Sinfonias. So once again, what would you say was Bach's intention for the invention?
As for the invention.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think that it's really, I would say that it's, I mean, the best way that I can say it is that they're like musical essays, you know. They're showing us how counterpoint can work. And instead of him writing some kind of written description that would be a guide, he wrote it using music. And so the music serves two purposes. It's on the one hand showing us something, and on the other hand, it's expressing something in its own right.
Do the inventions start more simplistically and become more involved or complex?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that they're quite diverse, and it's not a progression in that sense. I don't even really think that he would have thought of them being played together as a unit.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder when he sat down and said, "I'd really like to show something here. Maybe I'll do it this way, you know, and then I want to show something here, and I'll do it this way." I mean, is there some kind of a progression in terms of, not difficulty even, but just composition?
Well, there's definitely an exploration of the many uses of counterpoint. I mean, each invention and each sinfonia has a very particular musical motive. And depending on the sort of shape of that motive, he can treat it in a different way. You know, so if it's a motive that's kind of based on a chord, you know, like a broken chord, say you think of the eighth invention in F major, which is one of the most popular ones. It's basically an F major chord where he's playing around with the leaps between the notes in the chord. And because that's a major part of the motive, then he can play with it in a certain type of way. He can, you know, expand the intervals, contract the intervals, you know, turn them around upside down. I mean, there are lots of different kinds of treatments that he can do.
And what about learning how to play the piano through them? I mean, is that for technique as well?
I think that they were written also to show the keyboard player how to balance two different challenging lines in two hands simultaneously. So
a teaching tool, basically, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But very beautifully done.
Mm-hmm.
So have you learned anything from this? Did you learn something that you didn't realize you didn't know in terms of your own, you know, technique and... or is everything you play a learning experience?
Oh, I mean, everything is a learning experience, that's for sure. I'm always seeing how I can be better. I think that because it's so much sort of getting back to the basics of counterpoint, it's shown me things that I still need to work on or things that I could try doing in different ways. I mean, the thing about Bach is that you can really explore interpreting it in a variety of styles, you know. And I think that in this recording, I felt like I took a few more risks than I had done in my other recordings. And you know, hopefully each recording that I do, I can push myself further. But I did feel like I played more with some of the rhythm and...
And thoughts, I think. Yes,
yeah.
Yes, very exposed. Yeah. And beautifully done, actually. And I want to congratulate you once again on a very beautiful album. Anything on the horizon? Again, I'm sure you have many ideas about what you want. Where do you want to go from here, as it were?
Well, I have, you know, the usual, a lot of different concerts and programs coming up. But one thing that I'm in the very early stages of discussing, which I'm quite excited about, is working on a program with a contemporary dancer. Her name is Nora Chipamire. She's a Zimbabwean contemporary dancer. And we're going to do a Bach project together, and I'm very curious to do that. I've never worked with a dancer before. Mm,
interesting. Well, Bach is a good way to start. You are also, you know, you really made a tremendous splash, you know, with your Goldberg variations, which some, again, it's a complete change in terms of difficulty as well. But you seem to be going towards the classics, the early classics, I guess, and restating them. And I think it's heroic. I really do, especially
thanks.
In this day and age of the difficulty of recording and of selling recordings and so on. So I, once again, my hat's off to you. And
thanks.
And I look forward to hearing about this new venture. That sounds very interesting. What's different about working with a dancer in terms of rhythm, is it?
Well, I think I'm going to discover all the different things. We haven't started working. We've just been talking. But we've been talking about... how is one body, her body, going to reflect counterpoint? And I'm very interested in that. And I'm thinking that probably how her body reacts will affect how I play, too. So, the timing, the space that it takes to make a jump or to, you know, to do various different motions, and also what the... what kind of movements are going to be inspired by hearing the music. I'm quite curious to see what she's going to do. So,
so
I think
are
it's
we.
Going to be a very give and take sort of experience for us.
Yeah, it'll be wonderful. Wonderful, a new venture. And I wish the best to you as well. We're looking forward to the next blockbuster from you. So thanks again,
thank you.
Simona.
Thanks.
A pleasure speaking
All right,
with you.
Thank you, Jill.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We just heard the Symphony in No. 15 in B minor, BWV 801 by Johann Sebastian Bach, the final work on her newest release, Bach Inventions and Sinfonias, on the Sony label. I'm Jill Pasternak. You're listening to Crossover.
Celebrate with us. Come with us on a joyous journey, passing over from despair to rejoicing, from mourning to exaltation, from darkness to light, from enslavement to redemption. This is the Passover story. It's everybody's story, with a message for every age. It is eternal, as old as the hills, as fresh as springtime.
Theodore Bekel and the Western Wind. We have a very special guest today with us. All of our guests, of course, are special, but this one is particularly unique. Elijah Dornstretch, welcome to Crossover.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, tell us a little bit about why you're here and what you did that is so interesting and unique.
Well, thank you for asking, and of course, thank you for having me, and I hope it's interesting and unique. The feedback and all of the attendance has certainly been terrific. 3 years ago, along with my friend Warren Hoffman, we came up with this idea. Warren approached me and said, let's do something together. And what emerged from that was the Philadelphia Seder. And the idea at that time was we have one of the most beautiful organizations in the city, the Gershman Y, which does so much for the arts and culture of the city, for the Jewish community, and you know, frankly, every community in the city. Let's do something that kind of pairs the mission of the Gershman Y, which is all about the arts and Jewish culture, with some of the amazing artists who are performing at all different strata of the city, and do something which celebrates the Seder. And so this idea came together to do an eclectic arts dinner loosely formed around the Jewish Seder. And we tried it. And we did it the first year, and there were, I don't know, 200 people there, and people absolutely loved it. And there was a soul, more of a gospel singer, and there was a great dance troupe, and kind of these short segmented performances paired with the Seder. And we absolutely loved it. It became completely clear we should do it again. That was the second year, and now all of a sudden, it's the third year.
Well, to begin with, a lot of our listeners don't know what a Seder is.
Yeah.
So explain what that is. It is certainly it's for a holiday, as you said.
Yes. Well, my uncle says, and I hope I can share this, every time we go down to his house for the annual Seder outside Washington, D.C., he says, we give good Seder. And what he's referring to is the holiday, which is right around this time of year, every year in the Jewish faith.
Yeah, well, Passover, of course. Passover is how many days?
8.
It's 8 days.
Yeah. And it's a meal that Jews sit and have, which commemorates the biblical story of the Exodus from Egypt. And so it's a meal with a lot of traditional foods paired with readings from that story. And it's a time when family comes together, as so many traditions come together around food.
Yes, and children are very much involved. And I just remember as a child, I mean, I never knew what was going on. I just knew I got very, very sleepy when I drank a little bit of the wine.
Right.
But, of course, there is a book. We
yes.
call that a
Haggadah.
And there are special foods that are eaten during
yes.
that time, and lots of them. And that's what all this is about. So
and they're symbolic foods.
They're symbolic, and yeah. actually, the beauty of the Seder is really something that and the meaning of it for everyone, I think, is a very, very big and important milestone, because one really does feel the holiday, no matter how religious you are mm-hmm. or not.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what did you do? How did you change it?
Well, I think we changed it in two important ways without trying to change it fundamentally. The important way is to add the arts. We thought that that would be a good marriage just because, of course, the food is important.
Well, it is a series of prayers and mm-hmm. and drink and eating and drinking and toasting and so on and so forth. So it's really a meal,
mm-hmm.
and there is you use a Haggadah.
Yes,
it's a book that explains what one does and what each thing is supposed to represent. And we sit around the table with that book, and then there is a leader. I guess that's the way you would want to explain it to someone that doesn't know.
No, that's exactly right. And I think you know what we did is say so since it is a story. And we are saying certain prayers and we are basically recounting that story, it would be great to bring that story even more to life by pairing it with arts performances that are somewhat oriented towards the different stages of the story, so that instead of just relating it, which we do some of that, and doing the four questions and some of the things that are the elements of the Seder, in addition, if we can bring in the arts, it'll just kind of animate it and provide some more depth and joy to a bigger Seder.
The cycle has continued for thousands of years. A people in exile, one minute welcomed, the next minute hated and hunted. Mortal danger, moments of tranquility. Imminent annihilation, and last-minute deliverance. At this point in the Seder, we lift a cup of wine in thanksgiving and sing, "It is this promise that has sustained our ancestors and us, for not just one enemy has arisen to destroy us. Rather, in every generation, there are those who seek our destruction. But the Holy One, blessed be He, saves us from their hands."
Cello e corbil fad, un madoleno la calzenu. Cello e corbil fad, un madoleno la calzenu. La 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 la
So what makes this unique, aside from the fact that it's a Seder? I mean, that you're having performances? Is that what it is?
Well, and I guess it's that it's not just any performances, but, you know, our feeling in the beginning, and this continues to today, is we have some of the best artists in the world in Philadelphia. Now, some of them are very prominent and at the Kimmel Center, but some of them are kind of laboring beneath the surface and working their way up. And so we worked very hard to integrate into different communities and cultures in the city so that we could identify some of those artists, hopefully, and give them some exposure to the community of the Gershman Y.
But you're integrating their performances with the actual Seder.
Right. So that's I think the idea was to take the Seder story and reinterpret it and reimagine it as represented in these different ways of presenting art. So expressing yourself through jazz or dance is a beautiful way of doing it. An example of that is this year, the incredible tap dancer Jermaine Ingram, who has gotten a Pew grant to do a pretty complex and substantial work around slavery down at the former George Washington House in Philadelphia. She's going to do a version of that that is more oriented towards the Seder, which, of course, has a story of slavery, Jewish slavery in Egypt. And so Jermaine, as a really accomplished African-American artist, seemed really, you know, well-placed, and she was really agreeable to say, you know what, let me adapt the work that I'm doing and make it part of this. And so she's presenting Karpas, which is an allusion to the condition of the Israelites in Egypt.
Well, also, I think you're having some jazz singers or jazz violinists. Diane Monroe is a marvelous violinist.
Yeah, the quality of the artists has always been wonderful, and that's important.
So
that's right.
And we celebrate it, and we hail it once a year, and to have it interpreted by artists is lovely. It's a lovely idea. It's new. It's a new idea. And the kind of performances are not necessarily classical. They're not necessarily something you would hear in the synagogue.
Right. So, I really appreciate you saying that. And that's, I think, really the key, is that it's kind of deepening and broadening, but hopefully still staying very true to the Seder experience, so that people can just have a little bit of a new and fleshed out and exciting version of their Passover experience.
And there are questions that are asked, and I think we often quote, why is this night any different than any other night?
Right, and we're going to try and make it different.
And you're going to make it different, so right. I think that's terrific. Well, it's a great idea. Now, will you have each, how many performers are you going to?
I think we're having about five. That's typically what we've done in the past few years, so that it gives everybody a real taste of some different, you know, short, eclectic experiences without overdoing it. And we've picked, I think this year we've got some really wonderful and high-level artists coming. Jermaine, Hannah Rothman, who has been around quite a while and is a really funky and soul-inspired and bluesy singer-songwriter and guitar player. Charlotte Blake Alston, who's going to share a story about the march with Martin Luther King, et cetera. So, I mean, I think that these performances will be immediately relatable, have a lot of depth.
Unfortunately, they are very relatable, and they've happened to lots of groups of people.
Yeah.
And they represent what freedom is and what slavery is, no matter what your religion is, or I guess wherever you live. And unfortunately, it still goes on. And the story is true even now.
Questions without answers, puzzles, symbols, mysteries. The Passover story is brimming with surprises. The hero Moses is barely mentioned. Yet in every household, a handsome goblet is filled to the brim for the peripatetic prophet Elijah, the wandering prophet of a wandering people. Generations of sleepy children watch with wonderment, claiming to actually see the level of wine diminish. And as we fling wide our doors in welcome, we fervently hope that this year Elijah will finally drink from his cup and proclaim the coming of the long-awaited Messiah.
So how does one get to the Seder?
So it is at the Gershman Y.
Is there a special room there?
Or? Right, yes. In a beautiful space on the Gershman Y, right on Broad Street and the Avenue of the Arts. It's happening on a Sunday at 5 p.m. It's going to be the last Sunday of March, so in a couple days, March 30th. And people can just go to GershmanY.org to learn more about it and, of course, pick up a ticket for them and a family member that they think would enjoy it.
So they participate in the Seder, but at these points you have the performances.
That's right. Yeah, it will be a big group Seder, so meal for anybody, Jewish, non-Jewish, mm-hmm. and a chance to be entertained.
And when is it hitting Broadway? Tell me.
Hopefully the day after we do it at the Gershman
Y. I think it's a great idea. I mean, it's also something that reveals to the world,
yes.
you know, a beautiful, beautiful, it's not only a story, but it's the celebration of something wonderful.
Yeah.
And that speaks to everybody in every
language. Let's not forget, I mean, it's really the Gershman Y that should be credited for this because that's what the Gershman Y does. I mean, it's a Jewish cultural organization, but it's an arts institution. So I agree with you. If the Gershman Y can do this, then hopefully, you know, we'll take it to many other places and expand it.
So does one buy tickets or call? And how
yes,
does that
call
work?
Or just go to the website, GershmanY.org, to get tickets for a meal and a night of lots of entertainment.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And lots of wine. You notice I keep stressing the wine.
I have noticed that, and I think it's totally appropriate and will happen on the 30th as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once again, the call, the Gershman Y,
yes.
Is there a phone number for that?
215-545-4400, and they could get tickets and information that way, too.
Is it a limited number of people? Do you know?
It will be limited. I don't know the exact number. I mean, in past years, as I've said, we've had a couple hundred people, but the space can only hold so many. So I really encourage people to go to the website or call. Go to GershmanY.org or call as soon as they can so that they can be part of it.
It sounds terribly exciting, Elijah.
Thank you.
Dornstrich, thank you so very, very much.
Yes.
And it's really a unique idea, and we love doing unique things here on Crossover.
Thank you for having me on.
For a second listen to selected Crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Patti, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group, Incorporated. Thanks for listening.